our space, news gentleman in this channel. There is something not only that men made, but there are PC5 ways that are powerful wave process in terrestrial environment that modulate ionosphere. And also in magnetic storms, the magnetic storms can modulate ionosphere of plasma-sphere interaction significantly. So, I wonder what... I have another article about it. So it says, modulation of the ionosphere is a phenomenon that occurs when the ionosphere, the upper level of the atmosphere that is ionized by the solar radiation, is affected by magnetic storms. Magnetic storms are distributors in the Earth magnetic field caused solar activity. Magnetic storms can cause the ionosphere to change its density and height, which affects the flux, which is H, hydrogen, and oxygen ions in ionosphere, plasmasphere system. End of quote. So, I wonder if HARP was the consequence of Radio Luxembourg effect. Back to you.
Well, I do not know, Wesley. I do not think that they published regular data of their experiments. There were some somewhat paranoid people who thought that the government had set up a weather station to control the weather, and that's what they thought HARP was. There's going to be some kind of presentation this week. I received an email. I'll see if I can put it on the link page about HARP, the history of HARP. But I don't know. It's possible. The ionosphere can act as a nonlinear mixing medium in the same way that earlier I was talking about the chicken wire. Anything that can act as a nonlinear device can act as a mixer of two or more electromagnetic waves interacting on the plasma and can produce a sum and difference as all mixers do.
What makes you think that ionosphere is nonlinear?
Because there are a lot of articles on the subject of nonlinear mixing in the ionosphere.
The ionosphere is nonlinear only if it's affected. If it's not affected, then it's not. You have that, how do they call it, Borella effect on that beautiful scene that you can see in Alaska. Back to you.
Well, I'll tell you an abstract that I pulled out. It basically says, when the ionosphere is illuminated with two strong HF signals, nonlinear mixing processes can take place near the region of the reflection. The first direct experimental evidence of such processes occurring in the ionospheric plasma were presented in this particular paper that I have on my screen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the ionosphere, I think it serves no purpose to consider the ionosphere as a stable object. It's sort of like a river in motion. It ebbs, it flows. The waters, analogous waters ride high, they ride low, and they're ever changing. I've had experiences where the F1, F2 ionosphere produce a kind of conduit between me in Brooklyn and some guys in a town in Nebraska, where I can talk to four or five guys in the same town in a half hour, and then the conduit kind of fades away or sometimes reestablishes itself someplace else. So, you know, the ionosphere is an ever-changing river in my mind, rather than just kind of a layer that just sits there and gets thicker or thinner, depending upon the amount of magnetic storms and the amount of solar flux.
And you say that ionosphere in every inch of it is nonlinear because it's always disturbed. Is that what you say?
To one degree or another, it's not a matter of binary yes-no. It's a matter of gradients, of how much they're bubbling over and how much they're not. So, again, it's kind of like there are some things that work very nice in the binary. You know, it's either day or it's night, unless it's dawn or dusk. But a lot of other aspects of physics, such as shades of gray.
Very much about that. Any comments?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I spoke about the YouTube that Mark has with the different presentations, and there was a fella that knew everything about HARP. That was the topic, and this presentation probably goes on almost an hour. And it's one of Limark's YouTubes. And this guy knew everything that you have no idea how much this guy knew about the HARP program. Unbelievable. So, you know, it's worth checking that particular YouTube out. The HARP, I remember when they first started with that, it made it into QSD. They talked about it. They had hams do reporting when they were doing testing, and I believe just recently they did another test. Now it's not run by the original group; it's taken over by a college up in Alaska. They run the HARP program now, but recently they did a test. They were looking for hams to get involved. I didn't follow it though. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
Okay. Yeah, I got an email from David Barth, and he mentioned that there's a link, so I'll put the link up later on while you're doing your SpaceNet report. It was fascinating. The problem is that the government decided that they were tired of it. They were doing a lot of things off the books that they weren't sharing with us anyway. But eventually they just grew tired of the program and they wanted to shut it down. And it's sort of be a shame to shut down such a nicely made system. So they found a local college to take responsibility for the maintenance and such, and they handed it off to them.
That's good. Very good, yeah. Tremendous amount of antennas and all kinds of trailers with amplifiers and just tens of thousands of kilowatts that they transmit. It's quite a place.
Yeah, I think the underlying concept, or at least the ones that they gave the public, was that they were interested in how the ionosphere interacts with high-energy RF bursts. So, unfortunately, again, they didn't really publish that much that I am aware of. So the guess was that there was some military aspect to the research, and that was the reason why they decided not to share it with us poor mortals.
Okay. So the next thing, I'm going to need your help, Dr. Roy. I'm going to try. We had a discussion with Dr. Roy, and I was caught on me not misinterpreting certain phenomena. And I do appreciate this conversation. Victor Roy was no mistake, no error. But anyhow, let's say we have the road. And the road is curvy. It's like a U, U shape. And you remember when you were watching the racing cars, there was cars that were at the outer outer edge, the outer circle, were moving slower, and those who were moving close to the lowest, the sharpest curve, the inside of that road, the inner circle, were moving fast. The same is when we have the athletes trying to be first when they're running for gold. And then we have a similar situation when we have a water pipe. So we have a big, huge water pipe. And the pipe is bending U. And looking at that U, looking at that U, right? And we see that the water at the bigger circle, the outer curvature, is moving slower than that water, part of water that is near the sharp, the near circle of it. And then, this is a classical mechanics. Okay, fine. But now, imagine that we have a 10-inch flat aluminum foil. And we cut from that aluminum foil the huge, humongous U. The U, like a U. And for simplicity, we may say that is that U is upside down, but it's flat. And it's on the table, or it's on vertical, whatever. Now, we to the legs of this U, we connect the DC current, the power supply, and we measure the we try to find out if the car moves slower and higher and faster, or if the classical mechanics give us a certain experience, can we apply that experience to the current? Okay. So now what we do is we have that flat letter U, and we go to the very, very top of that U, right, because it's upside down. And we take the voltmeter, and we measure 1 inch on the very top of it with the two electrodes of that voltmeter. And then we go down to that sharp curve of the U. Then we see that when we go down, the voltage on that meter is becomes higher. Maybe Dr. Roy would be able to rephrase it better. The question is, why is that happening? Dr. Roy.
Well, as I mentioned on email, Leslie, this is really a tough one and an obscure one. And I don't know how best to phrase it. The problem is that you think you're talking about current, but you're really not talking about current, because a single conductor does not have different currents. They have differing current density, which is a different thing with different units. And the gentleman that you sent me the YouTube in Russian is demonstrating the current density of a non-uniform conductor, which has some interest to some people. But for the life of me, I would be hard-pressed to find anyone. Perhaps you have better luck.
Okay, so he gave the answer. In other words, you take the voltmeter and you take 1 inch of the area of that letter U. And when you have the outer circle, the curvature of the letter U, you measure just 1 inch of that flat surface. You put the two electrodes of the voltmeters and you see that the voltage, let's say, is 20 volts. The lower you go with that, to the sharpest edge of it, you see that the voltage is growing, it's becoming bigger. So my question was, why is that happening? But of course, if you know the voltage and we know that we have a steady power delivered to the single conductor, right, we can calculate the current. So we're talking about the current density. Right. But the question is, why the current density is different in that conductor? And to actually...
Because by definition, you are operating with a non-uniform conductor. If you were operating with a uniform conductor, the density would be equivalent across all aspects of the surface. Because this is not, then they won't.
Yeah, of course, I agree with you. Current density is in a flat U-shaped conductor is measured in ampere per square millimeter, let's say, or square inch? Millimeter is very small. 1/8 of an inch is 3 millimeters, if I remember properly, right. So the current in the conductor is uniformly distributed throughout this cross-section, but at that curvature, the density of the current is different. Isn't that because the electron, the charge in that curvature is repelling each other? And to HGM.
No, it's not because the charge is always repelling each other. That's part of what pushes them ahead.
It's logical that the repulsive force between neighboring electrons occurred on the curved surface must be far greater than the neighboring electrons on the flat surface, simply because those electrons are closer to, and therefore the column force must be greater. Back to you.
Not necessarily. It depends upon how it's populated. They're all filled with electrons. They're all getting a current. Because it's a non-uniform surface, they're having different current densities, so they're acting upon each region slightly different, although the total current remains uniform. It's just the local current density that's altered by the non-uniformity of the surface of the conductor. But ultimately, what does this all have to do with anything that you can plug in and use for anything? And, you know, I don't really, you know, it's vaguely of interest to some people. But you know, when's the last time you had a conversation about current density?
Every day, electronic engineer who is... designing PCB has to deal with that. And to
I don't know. Ed, you're out there. You've designed a few PCBs, right? Have you kind of worried a great deal about current density?
No, not much. But it's interesting. Now, I have a question related. Volume density is zero inside the conductor, right or wrong?
I didn't catch the first word. What kind of density?
Volume density is zero inside the conductor, right or wrong?
It sounds like you said volume density, so I don't know what that means.
Volume density. So In conductors, there are free electrons which repel each other, which you actually said, I don't know. Okay? A charge in the conductor is by virtue of those electrons, either an axis or deficit of them. So they try to obtain maximum distance between each other, which is why all the charge is charged. In a charged conductor lies on the surface or the volume charge density inside of the conductor, and that's why it's zero.
I get this sense that you're confusing skin effect. Skin effect only occurs at alternating frequencies. Direct current doesn't demonstrate any skin effect, and current flows through a cylindrical wire across the entire cross-section. So I'm not quite sure what you're alluding to. If you're alluding to high-frequency signals in which eddy currents and other things affect the flow of current and restrict it at the center, and most of the current flows at the skin level of the interface between the conductor and non-conductor, yeah. But that skin effect, and that occurs at alternating currents. Usually the degree of skin effect becomes important when you get the frequencies higher up. But direct current doesn't have a field effect, doesn't have a skin effect, and the current flows throughout the entire cross-section, as far as I'm aware.
I'm talking about electric charge inside the conductor. So the electric charge inside conductor is zero because electric charges in the conductor are free to move around and will distribute themselves. Now I'm reading right now because I especially checked the GPD for the first time in my life. Okay, so what it says. Volume density is zero inside of the conductor. Why? The volume density of electric charge inside the conductor is zero because electric charges in the conductors are free to move around and will distribute themselves in such a way that the overall charge density inside the conductor is zero. Okay? This is known as the principle of electrostatic equilibrium, which says that the net electric field inside of a conductor is zero in the absence of the external electric field. This is due to the fact that free electrons in the conductor will move in such a way as to cancel out any internal electric field. End of quote. Back to you.
Okay. I don't know where you got it from. Volume density is really, to me personally, a kind of a crappy term. It's a very generic term. It just simply means the density of any object. So, you know, if you're talking about charge density, I think it would be better to call it charge density than just volume density, because volume density could pertain to water. So, again, I'm not quite sure what you're grabbing for. I'm sure you know what you're grabbing for, but I don't. Especially since I don't have that article, so I don't even know what the subject of that article is. So I don't know what to tell you.
I think we're going esoteric. You can quickly search volume density. Volume density is zero inside of the conductor, and it's going to give you the answer. But anyhow, I believe that... Oh, there is plenty of it... I just searched it. Current density in metal, the current density in curvy conductor. Okay, and current density in, why does the curved surface result in larger accumulation of charge compared to the flat surface? Related to volume density. But anyhow, I believe we're going too esoteric. So thank you very much, and it's a time for Space Report.
Well, thank you, Wes. And you kind of slipped, you changed volume density to current density, which is much more specific and would have been more helpful at the beginning of it. Because, again, volume density, I'll read it off of the damn webpage. Volume density is the amount of a quantity, often mass, per unit of volume. So you weren't talking about the usual mass, you were talking about a current. So calling it volume density is a very obscure, generic term that doesn't really explain what you were even saying. But, okay, thank you very much. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I hope you kind of enjoy the slight change-up. I felt that the net needed a little something different this time. So if you like it, you can always email me and tell me you like it. And if you hate it, you can always email me and tell me you hate it. And if you want to suggest some topics for me to discuss in the future, you can email that as well. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Anyway, thanks to everyone. We'll be back next Sunday to do it all over again. But now it's time for the SpaceNet Report with Paul WS2N.
Thanks, UGS, WS2N. And I was just thinking about the water analogy that Wesley was talking about. I know if you have fluid in a pipe and you have one 90-degree elbow, that 190-degree elbow, the amount of resistance you're going to get is equivalent to the length of pipe of 10 feet. So let's say it's a 1-inch diameter, inside diameter. If that pipe is 10 feet long, that whatever that resistance would be, that would be equivalent to one 90-degree L, you know, and no matter what size you have, 2-inch, 3-inch pipe, you know, it's all roughly the same. You know, 10 feet of pipe equaling the resistance of one elbow. I don't know. I don't think that's going to relate to the electronic world, though. Let me drop it unless you want to talk about this further.
Yeah, I'll be more than happy. I mean, one of the points I think Wesley wanted to make was the similarity between hydraulics and electrodynamics. And it's kind of used regularly. If you've ever seen, and I'll post an image of Ohm's law in terms of hydraulic, where they show resistance as a narrowing of the pipe. They show pressure as someone pushing water down the tank, and volume as pushing pressure down the tank, and current as the net flow of water through it. So they're similar, but they're not identical. They're analogies. They're helpful for some people to learn. But if you stick very closely to hydraulics, you won't get very far in your electrical engineering degree, because water doesn't have water fields surrounding it and traveling at the speed of light as such. So it makes for a very pleasant analogy and an acute cartoon, which I'll post on my link page. But you can't dive too deeply, otherwise you'll be deeply confused. You know, the same way that we use the term quantum electron spin, and people tend to misunderstand and say, think of it as a mechanical spin, you know, like a top. But it's not mechanical. It's a quantum rotation of a equation, if you will. Anyway, that's my two cents.
Yeah, one more thing I could add to it is in every house, when we have a pipe connected to the chimney or in the modern heating furnaces, we have a pipe similar to 4 inches PVC pipe that is outputting the gases out, and you have elbow. The 45 degrees elbow resists as much as 5 feet of the straight pipe, and 90 degrees elbow resists as much as 8 feet of the pipe. So that analogy from mechanics, not talking about quantum words, is present in many other areas. Thank you.
said 8 feet. Well, the standard number was 10, you know, back in the early days when I learned about this. And it's fascinating. If you look at, like, they'll show fuel lines running to in a jet port, or they'll show heating lines running somewhere, and they'll long lengths of the pipe, and in the middle of it you see four elbows. You see, you know, it could be a 100-foot run, and you'll see an elbow going maybe 10 feet one way, and then another elbow, another 10 feet, another elbow coming back, and then going straight again. You know, and you have to say, why in the world they do that? It's adding all kinds of resistance to the line. But what that is really an expansion system, you know, for heating and cooling of the pipe, whether it's ambient temperature or some kind of heat or cooling inside the line. That enables the pipe to actually move one way or another. If it was just a straight line, at the other end, whatever you tied into is going to be pushing back and forth, could cause a possible leak. That's why they do that. Sometimes there's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of feet of pipe, and you'll see that four-elbow system used multiple. Just it's fascinating if you look at it. You see it on rocket engines as well. The line going around the bell of the rocket engine, you'll see, you know, all of a sudden it's four elbows. What did I get this for? Well, that's what it's for. Anyway, I'll continue on with the SpaceNet report. This is WS2N. I got away from my steam for the days. The Voyager spacecraft I talked about last week and a little bit the week before as well. Voyager 2 was temporarily lost in space. They had sent the command to Voyager 2, and wrong command, and the spacecraft, you know, did what it's supposed to do from the command. It turned a little bit. It put the antenna, the 14-foot diameter antenna that points directly to the deep space network on Earth, 2 degrees off. So then, you know, they realized what happened and why they weren't hearing anything from Voyager 2. And now they, you know, were worried that they would have to wait. Now this happened a couple of weeks ago. They were worried that they would have to wait all the way until October, because the Voyager spacecraft knows that if it doesn't hear transmission from Earth for a certain period of time, that it goes through a default mode, which it starts using its star sighting. You know, it's got these star telescopes that they can look at the different stars and know where it is in space, and it will automatically readjust itself to point back to Earth. They thought they were going to have to wait till October. But they decided to give it a shot and see if they could hear Voyager transmitting back to Earth, even so it was 2 degrees off. Well, with the with these 70-meter antennas that they have and 35-meter antennas on Earth, sure enough, they were able to slightly hear it, so they knew it was still up and running. So what they did is they sent the transmission, and they send it on, they receive usually on X-band, and they usually send it out on S-band. But anyway, they sent the transmission, hopefully that Voyager would be able to hear it and readjust itself. And sure enough, it started sending back data. It did hear transmission from Earth. Make a long story short, Voyager 2 is back and operating properly. But it's amazing. This thing is at like 130 some odd AU, astronomical units, away from Earth. And the other one, Voyager 1, is even further. I think it went around 160 or so AU. And these things are still transmitting away. I had this sum of the numbers. It was like 9 times 10 to the minus 23 kilowatts of power. So low, so little power they're receiving. But yet with this deep space network, they were still able to pick these signals up, and they're getting science back from Voyager 2 as well as Voyager 1. Any comments? A little low. Try again. I heard you, but okay. Yeah, it sounds like Ed. Go ahead. It might be a little difficult, but give it a shot.
The problem is that the antennas have to be absolutely pointed right at each other. Now, what helps is the fishes on Earth, what did you say, 70 meters? That is just huge. That must have many, many, many feet of gain. The problem is it also has a very, very, very narrow beam, so it has to be pointed right at Voyager, and the same thing is true to a lesser extent on the other end.
Yeah, they always are, and that's what happened. Got 2 degrees off, but yet they were able to listen to it with these big antennas, and they were able to pick it up and say, the signal, even though it was 2 degrees off, they weren't sure if they were going to hear it, but they knew it was alive and well. The dish on Voyager is 14 feet in diameter, and we have, 35-meter antenna here, and we also have the Canberra, which is 70 meters in diameter on the Deep Space Network. If anybody doesn't know what that is, every 120 degrees around the Earth, we have a set of more than one antenna. And sometimes they use a couple of them, interferometry to tie a couple of them together. That might be, let's say, a couple of them in Australia, and they'll use that. Madrid, Spain, or Goldstone, California. So each one is 120 degrees off, no matter which way the Earth is facing. We always have we're able to point an antenna toward any of the spacecraft that's out in deep space, New Horizon, or whatever they're looking at, and all the ones on Earth are adjustable, so you could, change azimuth and elevation to do exactly that. Do you agree with that, Ed? Back to you, WS2N.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But let me point out, you said it's 70-meter dish. That's about 230 diameter. We're talking It's a mirror, almost like the replacement telescope. Any signal coming in roughly of the size of the playing field on a football stadium, every hit that gets focused into the receiver. So that is huge. Absolutely huge antenna. But yeah, I agree.
Yeah, these things are massive. Then they've recently done a couple upgrades. I think 2 years ago, before COVID, they did some big upgrades to these antennas to improve their sensitivity. Transmitting that's another story. They could transmit tremendous power out of these things. They don't have to worry about that. The transmitter on Voyager's no more than 20 watts. That's it. They get a higher gain through this 14-foot diameter antenna, but the 20 watts, that's what I think they started out with. They lose they lose some transmitting power. They have these traveling wave tubes, two of them on each unit, you know, like one is a backup. And they're working good since 1977. Anyway, I'm going to move on anyway, unless there's another, unless you have another comment, Ed.
One quick comment. The satellite, you know, the Voyager transmitter is limited by the fact that it has a radioisotope generator. There's no way you can do solar cells. It's not just a pinpoint. So they have to use the nuclear, basically they have the nuclear material that will remain hot. So at 50 years, the piezoelectric, I assume, device to generate electricity. So every watt of power is coming out of that thing, and there's a limit to how much you can get out of it. And another thing is, you have to have a cold source, which is space, which is a vacuum. You have to depend on literal black body radiation, and that's a necessary part of the power generation. So getting that power takes a lot of work.
K2SCP.
Hi, Chris. You had a radioisotope thermoelectric generator. And there's three on each one, each Voyager. So, and then they have residual heat. That they have these heat pipes that run to different units to try to keep some of the electronics and equipment warm. But, wow. Over to you, Chris. How you doing?
Doing well. Thank you, Paul. I'm like dumbfounded listening to this. I cannot believe, first of all, that thing is 50 years old and still running like a gem, I guess. But how the heck did this thing... How do they make it to last so long? I mean, how much fuel? There wasn't only a couple pounds of fuel or something on board. I know that's a lot nuclear-wise, but how long do they think they'll actually get power to utilize this thing? I never really looked that up. And I just wanted to comment on the, I think you said it's like 150 or 200 AU or something now at this point away. And the 2%, off, as Ed said, sounds like nothing, but that 2% over 150 AU, for example, is probably a couple hundred million miles or something away from Earth that it was pointed. So it's just mind-boggling when you think about it. And then after saying all that, how crazy far this thing is away, what's even crazier is it really hasn't gone anywhere yet in terms of space. It hasn't even reached another star. I think I read somewhere it's like 40 more years or something before it even reaches a star or something ridiculous. It's just mind-boggling. It's crazy to think about this stuff. K2SCP.
Can I comment?
Oh, okay. And I think it's 40,000 years before it gets it. I think they're going to go... The first one's going to get near Sirius. And I think even that is going to be like 8 light years the distance. It's not even going to hook close to Sirius, but that's the closest one. I think they're looking at 40,000 years or something. Ed, over to you.
Yeah, of course. About the radioisotope generator, they do cool off. And I think the problem is it now is old enough that the radioisotope generator is cooling off a little, and they're still getting enough power to run it. But I believe there is a question as to get further and further away, and theoretically, the more power is actually going down. So there will come a time that just disappears into the void. I can't say when that would be. I guess another 10 to 20 years, but that's a wild guess. Now, as far as antenna patterns are concerned, I've worked with these narrow beam parabolic dish antennas. And when you say it's 2 degrees off, the antenna beam much loss are you willing to accept that you will still hear something? Oh.
RTG is the radioisotope thermoelectric generator. It's thought of around 109 watts each. They use uranium 238. And, of course, they have half lives, 80 years or so. I think it's 87 years. But even with that, they've lost a lot of power from these things over the years. I think it's 4% a year. So over the years, they've had to shut things down, different cameras, and no longer work. And then there were heaters to those cameras. They shut them down to save power to use the couple of ones, use the plasma detector and a couple of the other ones. And that information is stored and then transmitted directly back to Earth. They don't use the tape recording system anymore, from what I understand. They actually had a tape recorder on earlier, early on, that they don't use the digital tape recorder. But and I don't know if the unit, you know, when they get the information, it's already sent back to Earth right away. And to get there, back and forth, like Voyager 1, it's almost 2 days now. It's very close to two-day transmission. One day out, one day back. So, you know, they make a transmission. Like, even with this, they made a transmission. They didn't know if this thing heard it until almost 2 days later. Well, Voyager 2 is a little closer, so I think it was 10 hours short of that. So, yeah, it's an amazing feat for 1977, Voyager 2 and Voyager 1. Voyager 2 was launched before Voyager 1. And Voyager 2 had some problems with the rocket as it was going up. First stage cut off early, like way early. The computer system on board told the second stage, well, fire longer, you know, make up for it. Which it did.
Well, one more comment. That's promise only.
Okay. And then when Voyager 1 went up, when that went up, if it was the other way around and Voyager 1 had the problem, it wouldn't have made it to where it is today. It actually went to, when it went to Saturn, they wanted to see what Titan looked like, and by making that trajectory change late in the mission like that, it would have never made it to Titan, and they would have never found out the stuff that they did find out. So, yeah, Ed, back to you. One more comment.
You said it takes a day for the radio signal to get from Earth to the Voyager, and a day for the signal to come back. That means is one light day away, which is 1/365th of a light year. So if you say it's the closest star to go to is 8 light years away, so it takes that 365 times the about 50 years, you do the math, that'll tell you when it gets there.
2 STP.
You're right, one light day. What is the closest star is, what, 4 light years away, and that's Alpha Centauri. And this thing's not going to Alpha Centauri. It's the nearest one would be Cirrus, which I think is 8 or 9 light years away. Chris, over to you.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's 4 light years, the closest one, but that's just incredible, these numbers. I don't think most people actually really stop and think about these numbers and what it means. It's just crazy. It's really too bad there's not a repeater on board one of these things. So, you know, if you want to chunk the repeater on it, you key up on Tuesday, and you come back on Thursday and listen in. You get the beat back. Anyway, K2SDP.
Yeah, that would be great. Oh, I heard it. I heard it. I heard my CW. You know, send my call out. You send that out and back from over three times the distance of Pluto. That would be cool. We'll be able to do that with the moon. We'll have the Gateway space station in orbit around the moon, and they'll have a repeater on that, and we'll send the transmission out, and a little over 2 seconds later, you'll hear it come back. You know, that's about the best we're going to do until we get to Mars. Then we can do 20-minute transmissions, Chris.
Yeah, you know, maybe we should petition Elon Musk to send one of his rockets up there, like his car, just put a repeater on it and see how far we can hit it with legal limits. That'd be interesting, actually. I'd be curious to see how far we can make it. K2SDP. Back to you, Paul. Thanks.
The closest I ever got to doing something like that was with Juno, when Juno was launched 2012, and in 2013, I was making a pass by Earth, and NASA, well, JPL needed to test their plasma unit on Juno, so they asked hams on Earth to transmit the slow code. I mean, slow code. You hold the thing down for 10 seconds. That would be a dot. And then, in fact, they did all dots. They wanted to, I think I had to send high, and everybody did it collectively at the exact same time. And they wanted to see if this, not a radio receiver, but a plasma receiver, was working. And sure enough, it succeeded. And then anybody that participated, they sent a QSL card back to the participants. So I got one of them from JPL, which is pretty cool. But I think the thing was, I don't know, a million miles away or so, whatever at the time. So that's I didn't hear a signal to come back, but at least I got an acknowledgement that something received the signal. It wasn't a radio receiver, it was a plasma or a detector or something. Pretty cool. But, let me just continue. I want on talking about the moon, Chandrayaan number 3. That's a spacecraft from India. And it is, it just went through what I call TLI, Translunar Injection. It was launched on an Indian rocket. They call it a geosynchronous polar vehicle, the GSP, the heavy lift vehicle in India. And it was successfully launched, and it's done half a dozen orbits around Earth. Each time it goes around, it fires the upper stage, fires again to push it further and further away from Earth. And just I think a couple days ago, they did the final burn, which I consider TLI, Translunar Injection, and it's now on the way to the moon. It's got a lander on board. Chandrayaan 3 should land August 23rd, so about 2.5 weeks from now, toward the southern end of the moon. It's going to go into somewhat of a polar orbit of the moon when it gets there. And it's going to actually fire its rockets to slow it down to eventually bring it into a 60-mile-high circular orbit around the moon. And that should be around August 23rd. It's got this lander. It's going to separate from the propulsion unit. And hopefully it will successfully land. They tried this a few years back in 2013. It wait, correction, I think it was 2018, it didn't work out. It crashed into the moon. So try again. I hope they make it. It's got a little rover on board, and we'll see how India does. If they make it, they're going to join the United States in successfully landing on the moon. They're going to join Russia, China. We'll see. WS2S. Time to talk about that. I know 2.5 weeks from now I'll be watching to see if this thing lands. I did that last time too. They came so close. I mean, it came in, you know, and they had one. I think they said this thing flipped around because of some kind of software error, and then by the time it corrected itself, ran out of fuel. And next thing you know, it hit the moon at like 500 miles an hour or something. We'll see. It's got four legs on it, and if it succeeds, it's solar powered. It only to last one day on the moon, which is 14 days, 14 lunar days. So 14 Earth days is one lunar day. It won't survive the night, they said. Let me drop it. Here's a news story that I just started following recently. Lockheed Martin had plans on building another, instead of, let me put it this way, a space station. Not as big, you know, something to replace the International Space Station. You know, maybe it could handle four people or so. What happened was they decided to sell this whole project out. Lockheed wanted to get away from it. They turned it over to Airbus. Now, if you follow the Airbus company, that's a massive company. They build the A380 world's largest jet, and you know, they come out of Europe. I think they're headquartered in the Netherlands. And they got, you know, this company now has got involved with this space station. It's called Starlab. That's the name of the space station. I guess they're going to keep the same name. They're taking it. And anyway, it's a large unit. It's going to be 24 feet in diameter and roughly 25 feet long. It's going to have three different decks. The one lower deck is the interesting one. It's going to turn. It's going to be able to turn. I can't imagine how they're going to do this. It looks like the inside, you know, like there'll be two cylinders, and it looks like the inside one will turn and create gravity, not as much gravity that you would feel on Earth, but as much as you would feel on Mars. Mars is, what, 0.38, or roughly one-third of the gravity you have on Earth, and that's what they're going to duplicate. That's their goal.
That time, complete.
This way, for instance, go down, you know, you could leave the upper two decks, which might, you know, you might have living quarters, science experiments, you know, but the lower deck, you know, you could be where you're sleeping. They go up against the wall and go to sleep, or do different experiments at one-third G. So essentially it's going to have gravity inside of space station. Or the Starlab. So, you know, they have plans on, you know, visiting this spacecraft. Probably, originally, they'll probably use SpaceX to get to and from that space station. But they have not long-term plans, but short-term plans to eventually use the Ariane 6 rocket. Now,